Weight loss solutions are not one-size-fits-all. Hers makes it simpler to get started and stick with a weight loss plan backed by expert-guided online care that puts your weight loss goals first. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
My guest thinks that we need to take history more seriously in the responsible tech movement, that we should create space for historians to do certain kinds of work to help us do what we can to make sure that tech is evolved and applied in ways that are responsible, that are conducive to human flourishing. The two kinds of things he has in mind, at least, are first, that if you don't know the history, then you're not going to identify the real sources of the problem, and then you're going to create bad solutions, for instance, bad policy. So you want to do a root cause analysis. You want to find what really are the causes of the problems that we're running into now. Let's say, for instance, depression among teenage girls. And then we want to find out, is Facebook really the culprit here? Is it something else? To what extent is Facebook part of that problem? If we're going to devise an appropriate solution, to what extent does that solution or audit to target Facebook or Instagram or anything along those lines? So one, we need to understand the histories of problems if we're going to come up with appropriate solutions, including solutions that address technology, but also recognizing, I think that he would say this, that technology is not always the source of the problem. The second thing that Jason points out is that when we look into the history of, say, various platforms like a Facebook, then we start to understand the values and the assumptions of the creators, and in understanding their values, their assumptions, we'll better understand the platforms or whatever their inventions are. And if we can better understand them, then of course we'll be in a better position to critique them and to urge various kinds of ways of making it better. Notice that the history is important here because the people who make these things, the inventors, might not know about their own values and assumptions, or they might not be willing to be open about those things. So history or historical methodology is a way of learning about how the platforms got to be the way that they are, how the technology got to be the way that it is, and thus points the way towards appropriate solutions. Okay, so those are the two big things that Jason's going to talk about. Number one, we need to understand the history in order to understand really the sources of the problems. And two, relatedly, we need to understand the people involved who created these technologies and the applications that they built on top of them if we're going to engage in a helpful critique. Okay, those are the two big claims. Quick housekeeping things. If you want to hear me speak at a conference that's coming up very soon, June 12th to 13th in San Francisco, I'll be speaking on June 12th in San Francisco. It's the Compliance in the Age of AI conference. If you want to learn more about that conference, you can go to opalgroup.net/ethicalmachines, opalgroup.net/ethicalmachines. And I have a discount code, READ, R-E-I-D, 50, 50, READ 50. Is the discount code for 50% off. I would love to see you there. If you have any questions for me, people you want me to talk to, issues you want me to address, please email me at em as in ethical machines, em@readblackman.com, and review the podcast, share with people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, let's go talk to Jason. Jason, everyone knows that the reason to study history is because we'll learn lessons from it. But that's not quite your take, right?
No, it's not. In part because you could learn some really horrible lessons from history. Like, for example, you could study the history of the Holocaust and learn how to be a great ruthless dictator who kills millions of people. But you could actually learn how to be a better ruthless dictator who kills even more millions of people.
Stop going into Russia in the winter. I don't know why this is such a hard lesson to learn.
Yeah. For me, I think, well, for most historians, I would think that the first important thing about history is to actually learn what happened in the past, which it turns out is actually a very, very hard thing to figure out.
Sure.
In part because everybody in the past had agendas and different things that they were trying to do and achieve, just the same way they do in our present. So the past is exceedingly complicated. And obviously, it's a big place with lots of different people who try to do a lot of different things. And it turns out that the more sources you look at, the cloudier and murkier it gets to decipher what actually happened in the past with any rigor or credulity or fidelity. So that's the principal thing, is to try to figure out what actually happened in the past and why. And then from there, there's all kinds of different ways that you can apply that knowledge. But I wouldn't go into the past looking for lessons because, one, they may not be there, and two, the lessons that you find may not be the ones that you want.
All right, so then what is, if you like, I mean, I know that you think that there is a purpose of studying history, including in the context of talking about what we should do about various technological, societal issues today. So what is that? What are we supposed to be looking for?
Well, I like to tell people that I like to study history because it can show you that you're trying to solve the wrong problem.
Go on.
So basically, the public sphere, with all the different forces and agendas at work in it, can oftentimes try to convince us that XYZ thing or XYZ technology or XYZ policy is solving XYZ issue that arose because of something that happened in the present and the past. But oftentimes, when you do the deep digging to look into the history, you realize that actually there's a very different problem at work. And someone's either obfuscating what that problem is or not necessarily being completely truthful about what that problem is, or maybe they don't even know what that problem is themselves. They don't recognize it as a problem.
So give me an example.
So I would say one thing that comes to mind recently that I was thinking about was, I forget which election it was now. I should have researched this before I came on. One of the recent elections, I think it was 2016 or maybe it was 2020. Trump and Bernie Sanders, President Trump and Bernie Sanders, were having this back and forth in the public sphere about NAFTA and about the outsourcing of jobs in the United States.
Yep, sure. Right?
And if you listen to the debates in media and among policymakers and among people vying for political office, you would think that all of our problems about the loss of jobs in the United States, the hollowing out of manufacturing, began in the 1990s with NAFTA. And that if we just fixed NAFTA, that would solve the problem. In fact, when you go back and look at the history, it's a very different picture. NAFTA is part of the story, but it's not the complete totality of the story. And in fact, the loss of jobs, the loss of manufacturing, the hollowing out of the manufacturing sectors in the United States goes back 30, 40 years before NAFTA. It's actually part of a much different problem. And part of that problem is actually automation and the sort of relentless drive of capitalism to increasingly lower costs at the expense of people. But that's not what the elected officials were talking about and what the media were talking about during that particular election cycle. So for me, that was just one out of many examples of realizing that the deeper and harder you look in the past, the more you realize that sometimes what we're told is the problem is not actually the problem. And in fact, there's a much deeper problem there that no one is confronting or no one has the energy or the political capital to solve.
Okay, so now it's starting to come into focus, I think. So the initial proposition that's very common is you study history so you can learn lessons from there. But you're pointing out something like, well, we do learn lessons, but we just learn about how misguided our current approaches are because they fail to appreciate the historical complexity that gave rise to the problem in the first place. And I take it the claim is supposed to be, if you don't understand the historical complexities under which the problems arose, you're not going to develop an adequate solution, whatever that solution looks like, whether it's policies or laws or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think not all history is solutions focused. There certainly is that can be.
Yeah.
But as I said earlier, some of it is just actually trying to understand what actually happened in the past. And that may have a very practical, applicable solution for the present, or it may not be have an applicable solution for the present. But certainly when we're talking about things like technology and policy and what we should be doing around things like artificial intelligence or social media, to me, And I've had this frustration when I've gone to responsible tech events and conferences and things. To only look at this as a 2016 and beyond problem, to me, misses the forest for the trees. You have to look much deeper back into the history and take a much more long, extended view of a lot of different factors of society in order to, I think, get a better grasp on what the real problems are and what there could even potentially be solutions around.
You need to understand the history if you're going to create wise solutions. Is that right?
If you want to make sure you're solving the right problem.
Yeah. So give me an example there, whether, you know, you mentioned social media earlier, maybe an example involving social media and why history is important, other than like, yeah, Zuckerberg made it in his dorm room in this year. And, you know, what do I need to know about the history in order to solve, say, toxic content or anti-Semitic content or whatever it is on Facebook or Twitter or whatever. Sorry, X.
Right. So I wrote a book called History Disrupted, How Social Media and the World Wide Web Have Changed the Past. And in that book, I tried to get below the surface of social media and figure out why it is that it's so hard to surface really good history content on these platforms. And what I realized was it actually wasn't a content problem. It was a values problem. And so
what do you mean? So, I mean, I don't usually no one goes to Facebook or to Twitter to research history.
Oh, you'd be surprised. No? Actually, a lot of people do. In fact, when I did interviews for my book,
I am surprised.
It was amazing to me how many people, not only those platforms, but Instagram. So many young people, a lot of journalists, in fact, go to Instagram to find history content. In fact, on TikTok, at this time last year, there were 58 billion posts with the hashtag history. So this year, it's well over 100 billion.
So I see. So users are posting content about history.
And also going to those sites for history.
And then, right. And then as a result, people go to the, that seems bonkers.
Oh, you've got to read my book, man. It'll blow your mind.
A very shitty version of Wikipedia.
Well, a lot of it actually comes from Wikipedia, right? You think about history videos on YouTube, they're not doing the original research. They're taking the information from Wikipedia and repackaging it into videos. Now, I know as someone who was once hired to write Wikipedia pages for people, I know how completely biased those things are. But anyway, leaving all that aside, what I wanted to say about my book is what I realized was that actually this was a values problem and not a content problem. And what I mean by that is that actually built into social media are a certain set of values that are, I argue in the book, antithetical to the values of professional history. So to your question, why does all this matter? Actually, it turns out that if you want to get better history on social media, you don't solve a content problem, you solve a values problem. But you wouldn't know that unless you actually did the research and looked into the history, which is what my book does. And that's one of the reasons why I think people have been really drawn to my book, because it sort of makes an argument that a lot of people didn't know was there and didn't expect.
I don't understand the argument yet. So, okay, it's not a content problem, meaning the content is all fine and well, something like that. The content, what is said is true or true enough or something like that, sufficiently accurate, such that it's not a bad source as such.
Well, think about this. Like I said to you that there were 58 billion posts with the hashtag history on TikTok, right?
Yeah.
Invariably, within that 58 billion, some of it's going to be quite good, right? Some of it's created by professional historians. Some of it's created by journalists. Some of it's created by news organizations. Some of it's even created by historical societies. So it's silly to paint all 58 billion with a broad brush. The question is, and this is the question I grappled with in my book, which is, why do certain pieces of e-history content become so visible online and so influential online, and why do some not, right? You and I can both make a video about the American Civil War, and it can be equally accurate, but your video could get 10 million views and mine could get 10. Why is that? Right?
You tell me.
Well, I was setting up my own answer.
Okay, good.
So what I argue in the book is actually that the e-history that aligns with the values of the social web actually stands a greater chance of visibility than the e-history that does not. So basically, it has nothing to do with the content, has nothing to do with the information in the video or in the post, has to do with how well the post or the video or the piece of e-history aligns with what values the social web itself or the platform itself promotes. And so that's why I'm saying that actually, if you want to solve the problem of getting better history content, and this is just one example, obviously, but getting better history content visible online, you're not actually solving a content problem, you're solving a values problem.
Okay, so I still don't understand. So, all right, there's there's good and bad historical content. We don't even need to use the word history here, right? It's just we have good and bad kinds of content. It could be historical content, could be about astronomy or philosophy or biology. Like pick your thing, right? And we don't have a content problem.
If you're trying to solve for better online content, there is plenty of good online content out there. The question is, why does anybody see it?
Right. And so it's like a surfacing problem. How do we surface the right stuff and don't surface the bad stuff?
It's a visibility problem. Why does some get visible and why does some not?
Right. And that's going to be because, I mean, what? Facebook or something like that values sensational content more than it does accurate content. And so that gets liked more, or more eyeballs, or gets served to more people. And so that sense that they value eyeballs more than truth. That's why.
So I have a chapter in my book about Facebook, and the chapter is actually called Nostalgia on Demand. And so what I learned when researching about Facebook was actually that Facebook actually privileges and values nostalgia in the newsfeed. So nostalgic content about history actually does better on Facebook than content that's not based on nostalgia. So as a result, you get a lot of nostalgic content that becomes visible on Facebook and a lot of other content that might dispel nostalgic myths or that might be more scholarly or intellectual that does not achieve visibility. So basically what I'm saying and suggesting with my book and to you now is that if you wanted to make more content about history or better content about history visible online, it's all there. The question is, what does the platform value and how are those values built into the way the platform works? So you'd have to change the value system, which is the problem that nobody really wants to solve.
Okay, but that seems like, you know, call it a values problem, I'd call it an ethics problem, whatever. It's not a history problem, right? It's not, if we understand the history better, we'll better be able to shape policy, et cetera. It's just, hey, look at how it operates. It operates in such a way that it values sensational or nostalgic, et cetera, content.
But to know how it operates, you have to do the historical research to see how it evolved to operate that way. And that's what I did with my book over 5.5 years. You wouldn't know that unless you did the research. The historical.
Can I just ask him? I can't just.
Well, maybe you can, but I don't have a number to Zuckerberg.
Okay, so maybe the claim is something like this. At first, I was thinking the claim was going to be something like really, really robust, which is something like a necessary condition for having the knowledge that, say, a Facebook or any social media platform works this way is that you look into the history to see how it got to be the way that it is. That's a very strong claim because there is plausibly another pathway, which is let's talk to the people there. Now, they might not answer our questions, which means that pathway might be blocked.
Or they may not know themselves because they were in it. And that's the thing.
Sure.
When you're in it, you may not actually be realizing what you're doing.
So I take it, though, that you still have, if not that absolute robust, super robust claim of it's absolutely necessary, it's still something like it's a phenomenally powerful tool for understanding how things work as they do.
Yeah, I agree with that.
The historical inquiry, the understanding of how it came to be is a very powerful tool. It might not be the only tool.
Correct.
But it's a very powerful one. And appealingly, I take it what you're saying is, wielding that tool doesn't depend upon either the goodwill or the self-knowledge of the people into whom you're inquiring.
Perfect. That's why you have a podcast with tens of thousands of followers.
Is that why? I don't know. Let's look into the history of my podcast and then we'll figure out why.
But here's the thing. I mean, that is a use for history. I absolutely 100% agree with what you said, but it's not the only use. And there are some historians who don't take that tact, but it can be a very powerful use, especially when you're talking about trying to enact societal change and trying to write good policy. I think, unfortunately, oftentimes what I've seen in my own personal life, I don't want to paint everything with a broad brush, so I want to do have that caveat here, is that oftentimes policies get made without doing that deep digging, without doing that sort of intellectual rigorous work.
Okay, right. So policy is formed sort of ahistorically, and that creates problems because then the policy doesn't actually address
the real problem.
The real problem.
Exactly.
It's not really that it doesn't address the real problem or that it doesn't address the It doesn't address the source of the problem. But again, do you have an example of a policy that you think would be appropriate or has been tried out for either AI or social media or something like that, that fails precisely because they didn't appreciate the historical context of the problem they were trying to solve?
Ooh, man, that's a great question. I think on some level, the whole policy debate around artificial intelligence right now is the answer to that question. I mean, I think this has all sort of hit the fan so quickly, and there's been such a rush from policymakers in particular, because I think policymakers have wanted to learn from history themselves and not appear to be slow on this, like they maybe were slow on disinformation and social media. And so there's been this impetus to act quickly. There's been this impetus to write things quickly, to legislate quickly. And I just wish there was more space in there for historians and historical thinking and historical perspective, because I do think that if historians had the opportunity and the time to actually go back and look at the development of this technology over the past 50 or 60 years, we might land in a very different place about what we think we're regulating and what we actually need to put in place to do it ethically and effectively. And I just think we haven't been given that time or afforded that possibility because, one, the technology is moving so fast, and two, policymakers have an urgency to move fast for a variety of reasons.
What kinds of things would you expect to unearth? What's the sort of thing that one might discover and say, you know what, now that we've discovered X, or now that we know X, which we didn't know before about the history of this stuff, the policy should probably be, you know, going a different direction than it's going in now?
Well, I guess the other question I would add on top of that is, even if we did discover it, would anybody have the appetite to do anything about it?
Well, sure. That's a separate issue. Sure.
I'm not sure it is, though, because I think on some level, I think that there isn't an appetite to go dig deep and ask deep questions, because I think on some level, people don't want to actually tackle deep questions.
Sure. But suppose someone says, Jason, I'm going to give you a grant. And, you know, could dig into the history of AI or whatever it is, or social media, if you like. And on the condition that you can tell me what's the kind of thing that might turn up that would alter how we think about policy around this stuff.
So I think the thing that would probably turn up would be similar to what I turned up in my book, which is the values and assumptions that have gone into this technology in the first place.
I see.
And how we need to think about regulation in order to counteract those, if we believe that those are something that are worth counteracting. And I think part of that, again, if you were to ask me, like, what problem are we really trying to solve with AI? I think on some level, basically, we're trying to solve a capitalism problem. Right? The idea here is the people who are pushing AI onto us want everything to be faster and more efficient. And those are the ethos of capitalism, not necessarily the ethos of human beings. And so The question I think I would want to look into is, what are the assumptions and value systems that are informing the rapid pace of development of AI? And is that value system actually in alignment with what we want our value system to be as a society? And if not, what could we put in place that would actually balance and tip the scales back in the other direction?
I sort of see what the project is now in a way that I didn't quite before, which is something like, by unearthing the history, you get to a place where you can critique the way that things are now that you couldn't do otherwise. And one reason why that's sort of striking to me when I was a philosophy professor, I specialized in ethics, but my side hustle was Nietzsche. My philosophical side hustle was Nietzsche scholarship, and he wrote this famous. Right, it's what? It's a, that's a legitimate.
I just think it should be. I think it should be a band name. My philosophical side hustle.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah,
that's pretty good. mine was Nietzsche. Actually, I've always wanted to start a band called Mediocre at Best. And people, you know, you get on, lead singer gets on, say, we're mediocre at best. Yeah. And then they just start playing.
To the disappointment of every Jewish mother out there. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's why I didn't start the band. Otherwise, you know. But this is, I know this is not your area. This is more mine now, but it's, Nietzsche has a famous book called The Genealogy of Morality. And in The Genealogy of Morality, his goal is to make us question, roughly speaking, Judeo-Christian values. Things like thinking compassion is of the highest good, that the meek shall inherit the earth expresses a certain kind of value that he thinks is upside down or plausible, or at least questionable. And his whole method for critiquing the religious cultural values of at least Europe at the time was by way of doing a history of Judeo-Christian values and saying, here's where it all came from. And by showing you where it all came from, he thinks it's supposed to show us why it may have come from a really problematic place and why we should at the very least raise an eyebrow, if not outright reject the values that are instantiated in culture now as a result of the history that gave birth to it. So there's a similar story that you're saying. You're not talking about culture generally or something along those lines or religious values generally, but rather what does AI look like now? What are the values that it instantiates? And the best way to A, perhaps raise an eyebrow, and B, perhaps reject the values that AI instantiates, is to understand the history.
Yeah, and I've repeatedly said on podcasts and in interviews that I think, when I think about regulation of artificial intelligence, I think about it in terms of counterweights and counterbalances. And so, like, if AI has this incredible capitalistic momentum that is pushing us in a certain direction with all of its force, what speed bumps or what counterbalances can we put into place that would balance the scales back more towards whatever you want to call it, a humanistic view, a compassionate or ethical capitalistic view, you know, whatever it may be. Is speed and efficiency really the be-all, end-all of modern-day life? Because I think, and for some artificial intelligence applications and entrepreneurs and tech visionaries, that's what they want us to think. And I'm not wholly convinced that that's A, healthy, or B, the optimal end goal for our modus operandi as a society. So I think, but this is just obviously one area. Like, historians think about a wide range of areas, and some historians don't think about tech at all. They think about politics or think about culture or religion. Sure. But this is just one area that I've been thinking about lately.
Let's switch gears a bit, because I know that you have some things to say about the responsible tech movement, responsible innovation, goes under a variety of names. And I take it that you want to take your critical historical lens, is that the right word, to that movement. Why? I mean, isn't it just a good thing?
Oh, I think it's a great thing. I'm a huge fan of All Tech is Human, a huge fan of the Integrity Institute, huge fan of your work. I think there's a lot of good stuff happening. There's one thing I've been thinking about, though, and actually I think maybe you could help me flesh this out, because it's not a fully formed thought. You know, when I go to the conferences and I hear the speakers, all of whom are terrific and all of whom are making good points, part of me—
No, they're not. They're not all terrific.
Actually, I think most of them are, actually. I'm hard-pressed to think of ones who aren't. But part of me always walks away thinking that there's an intellectual backbone that's sort of missing. And I think that would be a valuable addition to the ethical tech, responsible tech world. I've talked with All Tech is Human about this. I know that they are interested. It's just always a question of finding the funding and building it into the framework of what they're doing. I think other people would be interested as well. But I feel like there's a longer history of responsible tech, right? I mean, if you think about, like, nuclear weapons, for example, to me, that's responsible tech, the fact that we're not detonating them. There's other examples too, but I feel like there's a longer history there that could become the intellectual foundation for that movement in a way that it currently doesn't have one. And I think it would actually also make the movement stronger if that was to be incorporated. So I've been thinking about ways that me and some colleagues, I have this thing called the History Communication Institute, which I've started, and I maybe there's a way that that institute could kind of build that out. But I don't know. What do you think?
Well, is the idea something like, you know, we're having all these conversations around responsible innovation or responsible tech, but they happen against a backdrop of ignorance about other kinds of responsible tech, if not movements, at least moves that have been made, like certain kinds of regulations in the nuclear space or automobile, et cetera. Is your idea that the conversation would be augmented if that history were known so that we could better tackle today's problems because we understand how they tackled dangerous technology in the past, although that's coming dangerously close to learning something from history? So maybe you mean something else.
Yeah, well, it's not fully fleshed out in my mind yet. I think you're onto something. I do think that it would augment the conversation. I think it would make it a more rich conversation. I think it would bring in different perspectives than sometimes get included in that conversation. Again, I think I kind of alluded to this earlier, but it feels like some of these conversations only go back to 2016, like as if everything that's wrong with tech started then. And I think obviously we know that that's not the case. So I think just going further back would actually widen the aperture of the things that we can discuss. I think it might also bring some, it's interesting, in some ways, I feel like there might be some old ideas that would be good new ideas. Like, I feel like there could be different things from those past movements that not necessarily would be lessons, but just kind of like would maybe enhance the thinking around how we mobilize and how we activate and how we shape policy. I just have this feeling that it would be a good thing. Maybe I'm not clearly expressing why.
Yeah. You know, I had a guest on the podcast, I don't know, maybe a month or two ago, Lee Vincel, who did a lot of work around regulations in the automobile industry and the ways that those came about. And it explains at least partially, if not justifies, his skepticism around current efforts to regulate AI. Basically, his point, if I recall correctly, is something like, there's these basic technologies, but they get applied, they get used in all sorts of unpredictable ways. And we don't know, the dangers come in the particular applications, not in the very general technologies. And so what we need to be protected against are those very particular applications, which you can't know if you like a priori. You can't know it before someone thought to use it in that way. And so making these proactive regulations, while it seems like the responsible thing to do because we're being proactive, right? We're not waiting until the shit hits the fan. We're moving before it does. Nonetheless, it will potentially unnecessarily hamper innovation and not do anything to protect us because the regulations won't actually protect us from the applications that we didn't foresee. And now the regulatory process has passed and now it's kind of too late. And so actually we need to, I mean, his view is something like, the problem is not with being reactive with our regulations. Being reactive is a completely fine thing. It's the speed at which we react regulatorily that's too slow. That's the problem. So if we could pass regulations in 6 months when we're like, holy shit, that's a really dangerous application. Quick, we better get some laws on the books. That would be good as opposed to, oh, that's really dangerous. Let's start off the regulatory process and maybe in, you know, 7 to 10 years we'll have something. That's the problem. So we need a kind of governmental reform about how we do regulation, not quote unquote proactive regulations that are had without knowing what the actual dangers are. If we do know the dangers, like with nuclear, okay, we can move fast and say certain things need to be contained immediately.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'd have to go dig into that more. I think it's we don't know the dangers. We also don't know the effects. I mean, we don't know the effects of these technologies until they're employed and 10 years down the road, we realize like we didn't necessarily know that all of us would get arthritis in our thumbs from using our smartphones until we all started using our smartphones and got arthritis, right? So like, yes, I think on some level, there's some wisdom there that we don't know the effects of using these things until we start using them. And we oftentimes don't know the full effects until 10 or 20 or 30 years down the line. So the sort of arrogance of making regulation now, just to say that we did it, doesn't really help us. And I think, again, that's an argument for history, right? Because history does show you the effects of things 30 and 40, 50 years down the line that studying things in short timeframes doesn't show.
Yeah.
And if you don't have any sort of sense about what the long-term ramifications of technologies are, even if they're older technologies, then how could you possibly even try to make sense of what the ramifications of current day technologies would be?
Well, that sounds good. And Jason, thank you not only for coming on, but for giving me an excuse to talk about Nietzsche, my philosophical side hustle.
Awesome. Well, thank you for having me and always appreciate the chance to chat. So hopefully we'll see each other soon.
Thanks so much, everyone, for listening. And now let me thank the people who have made this podcast possible. So first of all, we have Delano Alexander. He's been with me since day one. He showed me even how to start recording a podcast in the first place. He does editing stuff. He's been fantastic, and he does really everything I ask him to and more. I've never met anyone else who just says so much. Yeah, I don't know how to do that, but I'll figure it out. What more could you ask for in a producer? Next up, Jennifer Strong, my podcast guru. I don't know what else to call her. She just has advised me on how to design a podcast, how to grow it, and she's responsible for, if you like, this kind of season 2 relaunch and everything around it. So thank you to you, Jennifer. Next up, Meg Marco, responsible for all the excellent artwork. Before I did the artwork, I didn't really know what I was doing. We put it together. It worked well enough. But I think Meg really did a phenomenal job bringing everything together. Garrett Lang, sound engineer that I frankly don't deserve. He's just too good for this podcast. Don't tell him I said that, though. Next up, Benjamin Kultgen. He is a professor of philosophy who has helped me source guests, identify who's interesting, who has things to say, etc., etc. So without him, I wouldn't have anyone to talk to. And then finally, Ashley Wasilenko, who helps with all manner of administrative things, making sure that the podcast guests find their way to the podcast, can schedule the recording, get their bios and headshots, and really just keeping the show on the rails and me organized. Thanks to all of you. Really appreciate all your hard work.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.